This is Midwest Moxie, a show about our region's visionary entrepreneurs and the experiences that shape them. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher, Executive Director of Five Lakes Institute. Mike Evans wasn't aiming to make an outsized amount of money or take his company to a giant payday, both of which he ended up doing anyway. He just wanted to create an alternative to thumbing through the yellow pages for food delivery options, quit his boring day job, and pay off his student loans. In other words, discontent and debt drove Mike to start Chicago-based Grubhub. 20 years after Mike founded it, in 2014, Grubhub raised nearly $200 million in an initial public offering. It was acquired in 2021 for $7.3 billion by Amsterdam-based JustEatTakeaway.com. Mike, welcome to Midwest Moxie.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You wrote a book called Hangry, A Startup Journey. It's about your Grubhub experience. You wrote it without a ghostwriter. I'm so impressed. It's very well written. In it, you say that your story will be disappointingly uninspiring for the Silicon Valley crowd. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think there's something about the way we talk about entrepreneurship and startups, where it's you're following a plan. And that plan has really well-defined steps. You know, you go to business school, you create a business plan, you go to a competition, you win the competition, you get a Series A investor, or actually you get this friends and family money, which who knows where that comes from, right? And then there's sort of these steps that go along. And the final step is always make a big pile of cash and then you'll be happy. And I think that that doesn't work for a lot of people. Not because we don't all want resources and want to be able to buy the things that we like. It's because that as an endpoint, as a goal for our lives, it doesn't resonate with everybody as the thing that they're trying to do. A lot of people, you know, will have goals around family or relationships or career or legacy or whatever the case may be. And so I talk a lot in the book about this idea of a personal definition of success and how it's really important to define what the endpoint is for yourself in a unique and explicit way that doesn't just take the spoon-fed version that everybody else will give you.
Just to keep you honest, you did win a business plan competition in the early days of Grubhub, right?
Yeah, it was about 4 years after I started the business. So I did it out of order, which I think still, my answer still counts.
I'll give you that. Let's talk, though, about those, especially first 4 years of building the business. You know, tell us about the all-night coding, your pursuit of restaurants as customers, all the things you did pretty much single-handedly in the beginning with a day job, right?
Yeah, so the first year, it was definitely more of a hobby. I hadn't sold any restaurants. I was just coding. But then I did quit my day job and went full-time just after my co-founder, Matt, had sold the first restaurant. So I went full-time. And then at that time, it was literally during the day, I was trying to sign up restaurants and they would say things like, you know, it'd be great if you had coupons on your website. And then I would go like that night, I would go home and be like, okay, I guess I'm coding up coupons tonight. And then the next day they'd be like, you know, it'd be great if there was a catering section on the website. I'm like, all right, I guess I'm doing catering tonight. And so it was that sort of iterative process of finding out what my customers wanted and then delivering it to them, and then finding out whether or not they'd actually pay for it or not after I'd actually already written the software.
So when Grubhub was raising its first funding, your investors said only one of you, you or your co-founder, Matt Maloney, could be CEO. And you had done all the early work. A lot of people would have taken that, but despite the fact that you did all the work initially and started the company, you agreed to have Matt be the CEO. Why?
Yeah, this goes back to this idea of a personal definition of success. You know, I wanted to create a company. At the time, I was thinking to pay off my student debt. I had about $260,000 in school loans. And there's this thing that happens in startups when the company sells, where you end up having to work for the company that buys you for 1, 2, or even 4 years before you actually get paid. And the idea of sort of just marking time in sort of this weird indentured servitude sort of state was so appalling to me that the agreement that I made was, that's fine, you can be CEO and I'll be more, you know, behind the scenes, but that means I'm behind the scenes after a sale too, and I walk away with the cash. And so that was the agreement that we made. And that was really important to me. It was in line with my goals so that I could go on to do other things in my life that I wanted to accomplish. And so that's the agreement we made. And I was happy to do it at the time.
It says something about you. You kind of have this recurring theme in your startup journey of this thirst for freedom.
I do. I spent some time in therapy talking about this, in fact. For me personally, autonomy is really important. The ability to choose not only what activity I'm doing on a given day or a given week or a given month, but how that activity ladders up or connects to a goal that's in line with my ideals and my values. And I think that's really important, understanding where you're going, how your values align, and then making sure that the daily, maybe not every day, but most days, that your activity is lined up with those goals in a way that's really clear. And so that's why the autonomy is so important to me, is because I want to be putting effort towards making the change in the world that I want to see, and not just working towards someone else's vision.
It's a true entrepreneur way to look at it, though, that you can tell the real ones from the fakes, right? Because the real ones just, they don't want anybody telling them what to do. They want to do it themselves. They want freedom to do it. And you even resisted a board for a while, right?
Well, I didn't understand the purpose of the board. And so because I didn't understand it, I resisted it. But I had a mentor, Chuck Templeton, who founded OpenTable. And he convinced me that the value of a board of directors was that they can point out your blind spots, and they can tell you the things that you don't want to hear about yourself and about your business. And he convinced me that getting a board of directors would be a personal growth experience where people would push me and challenge me. And I would learn a lot, not just about the business, but actually how to be on a board of directors and how to think at that level and how to think strategically. And so he convinced me that actually what I wanted for my life, that my goal was to learn and grow, and that's why I needed a board of directors. And so he changed my mind about what my goals were. And once my mind was changed about that goal, and that a board of directors would actually help me get to that goal of learning about how to run a business better, then it became, I stopped resisting it with my activity, right? And so that's a big part of the entrepreneurial journey, is being wrong about things. You take these sort of very risk inherent activities, and you're not always right when you sort of take that leap. And so part of the journey is having people around you who can tell you that you're wrong, that you need to change your mind, because you are wrong frequently as an entrepreneur.
Well, as a human being, right?
Yeah, it turns out it's helped in other areas of my life as well, like having a 3-year-old who also is convinced I'm always wrong about things.
Yeah, wait till she's a teenager. At about 20 employees, you added the goal of paying off your student loans. Well, you added to that goal. Your original goal was to pay off your student loans. You had considerable student loans because you got your undergraduate and graduate degrees at MIT.
And then I added to that goal. The goal went from being just pay off my student debts. I recognized that I was going to hit that goal. I didn't actually have the cash. I still had the debt. But I saw the trajectory. And I changed the goal to I wanted to have a business that helped independent restaurants and make it more likely for them to survive. Independent restaurants, like 30% of them close every year. Like, it's a brutal business. And so I wanted to change that number. I wanted to make it more likely for businesses to succeed.
You achieved that for a while. At a certain point, you felt like Grubhub was moving away from that goal. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think at the time of the IPO, we had 70,000 independent restaurants and either zero or very few chains in the combined business of Grubhub and Seamless. And that was great. I love that. We were really good at keeping restaurants were more likely to stay in business if they signed up for us than if they didn't. And we were even making them more profitable. And so that was great. Something happens when you become a public company, and there's an insane amount of pressure to make quarterly earnings reports so that your stock price doesn't go down. And that pressure wasn't in line with the goal. And over time, the members of the board had shifted just because there's sort of expectations around public boards. And there just wasn't appetite in the boardroom either to maintain the goal of helping independent restaurants. And it became more about profit. And so that wasn't a goal that I was interested in supporting. And so I decided to go my own way, decided to leave the company and do something else, because the same theme of my goals no longer aligned with where I saw the company going. I don't want to oversell this point. The company is not evil. Like, they still help independent restaurants. It just wasn't their main, it wasn't their main focus. And it wasn't after the IPO. And I just didn't want to be I didn't want to be a part of an organization where that wasn't the main focus.
Well, that was a great summary and a nice way to say it. But I have to say, having read the book, if you want the dirt, you just go read the book, because you dish. I mean, I shouldn't say dish. You really explain, you know, the levers and tools that are that you kept in a certain place for a while before the IPO.
Yeah, I think one of the things I learned was that organizations act the way they do because the people that are in them act the way they do. And so if you want an organization to be mission oriented and values oriented, you have to have the people in it that are that same way. But if you want it to stay that way as the people move on and do other things, it has to be built at a deeper level into the DNA of the company, where you only hire the people who are laser focused on that mission and on those values. And certainly that just wasn't the case at Grubhub. Like, I felt that way. A lot of people at the company felt that way. But as people left, as I left and other people left, it became less and less the case. And I think it's a cautionary tale, you know, and it really informed my next business that I created, where I actually built it where the corporate charter has our mission and values mission in it. And we use it for hiring and we use it for bonusing and we use it for everything. And so this current business, that mentality will exist beyond the time that I'm here at the company. That was something I learned from my first experience at Grubhub.
To begin with, you set it up as a benefit corp, which is a special kind of corporation where the mission is tied to the profits in a sense. It's called Fixer.com. Tell us about the company you're working on now in Chicago, in the Midwest.
Yeah, it's founded here in Chicago. We're in 5 cities now, Chicago, Phoenix, Dallas, Denver, and Seattle. And we just launched Milwaukee. And I'm sorry, not Milwaukee, Minneapolis. Minneapolis. Milwaukee's coming. Sorry, they're both M cities, and they both have NFL teams that are not the Bears. Sorry. And so Fixer is an on-demand handy person company. And the idea behind the business is that we train a W-2 workforce from scratch to become handy people as a gender inclusive entry path into the trades.
W-2 meaning full-time with benefits?
Yeah, full-time with benefits. That's right. And the reason that we think it works is because there just aren't enough people to do the work and there aren't enough entry paths into the trade. And so we can deliver a really good experience to customers' homes. At the same time, we're increasing the diversity and skill of tradespeople in the communities we serve. And those two things are very linked. The impact and the profit are one and the same in our business. And that goes all the way back to what, as you mentioned, as a public benefit corporation, in our corporate charter, we have a dual mandate to create profit for shareholders and to increase the skill and diversity of tradespeople in the communities we serve. And that goes all the way back to like the filing documents we filed in Delaware, right? Which is a really weird, it's a very atypical corporate structure, but our investors are on board with it because they see that the link between the impact and the profit can't be broken. That's the only way to go about solving this problem.
But I get it. It's kind of like Grubhub, where you're starting the restaurants as well. You're training the handy people to do the work that you sell online, as it were.
Yeah, I didn't start all the way from scratch. I picked a business where, you know, before we came along, you had to order by phone and leave a voicemail and get put on hold and all this. And all those things currently exist in the residential sort of construction and repair space. And we're trying to make it just easy. Like, just you don't have to actually use the phone app on your phone. You just use our app and schedule somebody, and we show up on time, do great work.
Sounds idyllic. We're talking with Mike Evans, co-founder of Grubhub, and we're going to take a short break and come back and talk about the emotional journey of taking a company from the beginning through an IPO. We're talking with Mike Evans, co-founder of Grubhub, an online food delivery platform that is now owned by JustEatTakeaway.com. Mike's new company, Chicago-based Fixer.com, is building a just-in-time handyman service. But back to Grubhub. Mike quit after the IPO, rode a recumbent bike across the country, and has written a book called Hangry about his Grubhub experience. Your book, Hangry, is such a real-life picture of a company builder's experience, partly because you're so good at telling, as if in real time, how the business evolved and pivoted. For example, you talk about the realization you had 18 months into the company that it was a bad idea to build it around phone orders. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, that was a facepalm moment for sure. So I fast forward into a couple years into the company, and I had figured out that like a delivery guide with subscription price, it was just a pain in the neck to sell to restaurants. And so I switched to selling these phone orders. People would call in and place an order, and we would record them. And you know, we obviously told people they were being recorded, and we would just charge for the orders. And then I had this moment where I realized that all the infrastructure I'd built, all the restaurants I had signed up.
All the coding you did.
Everything I'd done. I could have just built online ordering. And it literally hadn't dawned on me until after I had been running the business for 2.5 years. And I say this in the book that like companies talk about pivoting and like they have an idea, they have a good idea, and then they figure out a slightly better idea and they sort of move. This wasn't that. It was just I had a terrible idea that I had ground away at for like 2.5 years. And then I had this like moment where I was like, oh, this other thing would have been much easier and much better. And so I switched, and literally the revenue in the company like tripled basically over the course of a week. And that was, it was frustrating, but it's tough because it's not like I have regrets because I didn't know at first. You learn as you go. And it's both a frustrating moment because you're like, boy, I wish I had started with this, but it's also satisfying because you're adapting as you go.
But that's one of the great things about the book. For an entrepreneur to read it and see, often that stuff gets glossed over in the retelling, right? And you put it all out there, and your pain is someone else's gain, I have a feeling.
Yeah, it's not easy. And the thing is, I even forgot this. Like going towards the IPO, I forgot how hard it was early in the book. And the actual action of writing the book and thinking, really remembering what it was like and looking back at my notes and my emails and all the things. And I was like, wow, this is really hard. And then that was underlined again as I started a new company, that it's just not easy to create something from nothing and then sell it to customers who will pay you. It's a very challenging sort of activity to do. And the startup story, like the typical startup story about like, I go to a business school, I create a business plan. It's not that straightforward of a path. It's a much more sort of drunken random walk than it is like a clear, I went from point A to point B.
Every serial entrepreneur I've ever talked to has said they forgot how hard it was when they got to the second company. They relearned how hard it was.
Right? Yeah, I am literally relearning that daily again the second time. And it's also exciting though. I mean, hard and fun can be the same thing. Right.
The guy who went to MIT.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I do enjoy a challenge. Well, actually, I disagree. I don't think it's just people go to MIT. I think it is literally the human experience is that we're most satisfied when we're doing work that aligns with our values and it challenges us so that we're learning. I watch my daughter, who's now 6, in school, and learning is a fun, like she seeks out things that are fun, and she gets bored if she's not learning, if she's not challenged. And I think that it may actually be the adult human experience as well, but we can cover it up. And so I actually do think all of us within our talents are satisfied by challenge.
You say something like that in your book that I don't remember the exact phrase. We're all faking it. We all have the imposter syndrome, I think is what you said.
I do. Yeah. We all have self-doubt. I still have an imposter syndrome. I create a multi-billion-dollar business and I'm doing it a second time. And I still look around and like wonder if the adults are going to show up and take it away. It's the people I know who don't have imposter syndrome are incredibly unself-aware and don't really learn very well. So, I don't know who can't have that feeling.
I counted, you use the word hard 128 times in your book. All the things you were doing, they were hard, and riding your bike across the country, your recumbent bike across the country was hard. Tell us about your 5 rules for hard things.
Yeah, so my first one is hard things are hard. When I talk about that, you know, the bike experience, riding a bike across the country was wonderful, but it was also hard. And the wonderful doesn't cancel out the hard. It's both those things at the same time. And that's true for, I think, a lot of the areas of my life and probably most people's lives. And because of that, they have consequences. You know, on the bike trip, I tore a muscle. It was really painful. It was kind of miserable. In the business world, you know, it was difficult on my relationships that I cared about. my marriage and others. But then they also had big rewards. My sort of third rule is hard things have big rewards. And it's true that like when we set big goals and we hit them, the rewards to that internally, personally, I'm not talking about cash. I'm not talking about wealth. I'm talking about the satisfaction from achieving something that wasn't easy to do is tremendous. And then there's sort of these two things that are maybe more practical. That sort of rule four is don't give up at the end of the day. And so I developed this one on the bike trip. There was a lot of days where I'd ridden 80 miles, gone over a mountain, and I was just done. I'm like, get me home. I'm going to throw my bike in the garbage and just go home. And then someone had mentioned this on the trail, like never quit at the end of the day, quit in the morning, have a nice night of sleep, wake up in the morning. So you feel, if you still want to quit when you're fresh, then it's because it's not aligned with your goals. And so do it, quit, but don't do it just because you're tired. And then there's this fifth piece, which is really the punchline of the book, which is if you have a vision, if you have a goal, if you know where you're headed, the hard things become much easier. And I think that that's been true, not just with Grubhub, not just with Fixer, not just with the bike trip. It's been true with child rearing and with everything. There's actually a line from Seven Habits of Highly Effective People that says start with the end in mind. So this is not a new concept, right? If you know where you're going, the steps to get there, even though they may be daunting, are much easier to take.
There was a point in the book where I laughed out loud, and I never laugh out loud when I read books, but when you had all those dogs chasing you in Kentucky?
Yeah, it turns out that when you're riding your bike across the country and you go through an area that's more rural and they don't have fences for the dogs love the game of chase. And at first it was really terrifying, but I developed some techniques, one of which was just blowing a whistle really loud. But in the end, it wasn't good enough. In the end, one of the dogs caught me, but then it actually licked my face. And so it was sort of this interesting experience of like, here I am trying to figure out how to run away from these animals who are terrifying me. But then when one finally catches me, it's like the cutest. It was this really nasty looking, angry looking bulldog. And it's just like licking my face. And I didn't want to learn the lesson of be careful about animals and guard yourself and stuff like that. Like, that's not what I set out to learn on the trip. And so I was learning that. And then I was pleasantly surprised that in the end, I was fine. I actually hurt myself from falling off my bike more than I did the dog hurting me.
I want to say, though, that's one of the amazing things about the book. You switch off telling the Grubhub story and telling this story about riding the bike across the country. So it's like a twofer. You get the entrepreneur story and you get what it's like to ride a bike across the country and what you find and how many plates of hash browns you can eat.
Thousands. You can eat a lot of hash browns, especially when you're burning 6,000 calories a day biking. That was great. I could go back and do that again. It is two different stories, but the common theme is that, you know, I had a goal with each one of them, right? When I started Grubhub, I wanted to pay off my student loans. And when I started the bike trip, I wanted to sort of get my head back on straight and also get to the other side of the country, right? There was the physical goal as well. I think it's the nature of the human sort of journey that as we approach our goals, we're changed. We change as a result of trying to do hard things. And then the goalposts move. This is either really encouraging or really discouraging. I'm not sure. But in some sense, you can kind of never reach your goals because the process of reaching them makes you reach for the next step. The goalposts move. But it was very satisfying to sort of go through that change in both of those experiences, go through change in the middle of it and want different things when I was in the middle of the journey than what I wanted in the start. And by the way, that's okay. Like, it's okay to quit your original vision and to create a new one because you've changed or because it's not working or for whatever reason. And we put so much stigma around this idea of quitting and of changing what you're striving for. But I actually think, you know, by giving yourself permission to move on to a new set of goals, it makes it easier to take the risk in the first place.
A lot of people strive for the kind of success you've had. You say, though, that when you achieve it, you find it has an obligation all of its own. Can you explain that?
Yeah, there was an obligation during the journey, and there was also an obligation when I hit the destination, right? So the obligation during the journey was I had this tiger by the tail, and it was just going through the roof in terms of its growth and its success. And we were going from, you know, 10,000 to 20,000 to 40,000 restaurants, and really like we became, in some of those restaurants, we were driving 60, 70, 80% of their business. And so we, there was an obligation just to do right by the people who had become to depend on us and put their livelihoods, you know, in our hands. And then there was an obligation internally, like for me personally, in terms of my relationships, I had to balance the amount of time and the needs of my relationships versus where I was succeeding in my business. And sometimes I made a choice that wasn't great for the relationships and it was hurtful for the people around me. And then later on with obligation, the obligation was, you know, a lot of us get to this point, whether something bad happens to us or good happens to us, we say, well, why me? And if it's bad, we say, why me? And it shouldn't happen to me. If it's good, we say, why me? And we usually answer the question with like, because I did it. And actually, I think it's just an irrelevant question, regardless of what the answer is, it's an irrelevant question. The question is, what now? You know, when something bad happens to us, it's way more valuable to say, well, what now? How am I going to deal with this? Am I going to be present? Am I going to adapt? It could be health. It could be financial. It could be a lot of things. That's true with success as well. It comes with an obligation because I didn't create Grubhub on my own. I had a co-founder. I had a board. I had investors. I had employees. There was, you know, the government built the roads, the delivery drivers, you know, just all, I stood on the shoulders of giants. I didn't do it by myself. And so having got to the point where I benefited from that, there's an obligation that comes in terms of what am I going to give back to society? How am I going to be the change that I want to see in the world? And my answer has been create another company that is even more impact oriented than the first one that I created. And I think that all of us should ask that question, regardless of certainly it's actually maybe even more imperative for people who've had success. Instead of saying like, I earned this, I deserve, you know, to buy a private island. Instead saying, well, how can I pass this forward? How can I make a difference in other people's lives? Literally the goal of my book, the whole reason I wrote it was for this reason. So that if I could change 10 people's minds who are starting a business or who are working through their careers to think about the change that their activity creates in the world around them, the social, the impact it has on society. Because startups and businesses have an impact on society, regardless of whether you want them to. They're a huge lever for social change. And so being intentional about that is critically important for people who start businesses or people who are just in businesses. And so that was the goal of the book, is to get 10 people to think about that. If I can do that, then I've succeeded.
I think you're going to get more than 10. Thank you so much for having this conversation and being so real about your journey with Grubhub. And good luck with Fixer.com. I'm sure we'll all be hearing about it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. I really appreciate it.
You can read more about today's guest by visiting WUWM.com. Don't forget, you can also listen to the show as a podcast if you'd like to take us on the go. Just search for Midwest Moxie wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your host, Kathleen Gallagher. Midwest Moxie was created by executive producer Audrey Nowakowski and me. Today's episode was produced by Audrey Nowakowski. Join us next Sunday at 7 p.m. to hear from more visionary Midwestern founders building innovative companies. That's right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.